Hello, and welcome to 2004 Elder Hostel. Today's date is September 20th, 2004. Today's session number is HAC 2004-01. Today's speaker is Cliff Hall. And the lesson for today is Session 1 of Health and Wellness for the Over 50. Healthcare in the 21st Century. Personal, national, and global perspectives. Let's listen in.
And thank you all for coming and actually coming to the first session on a day like this when you could be out looking at the mountains and walking around this really beautiful, beautiful setting. This is the first session of the 2004 Elder Hostel here at Fulton Village. And the topic is health and wellness. I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself before we start and give you a brief overview of what I think we can accomplish and explore during this this Elder Hostel session. I'm Cliff Hall. I'm a native of Massachusetts and a diehard Boston Red Sox fan, so if anyone questions my faith, certainly my ability to root for the Red Sox all these years is an indication of looking beyond something. I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts, went to medical school at Columbia, and did my training at University of California, San Francisco, and then at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda. I spent some time at Bethesda Naval Hospital while I was there, and I'm trained in internal medicine, pulmonary disease, and critical care medicine. For 30 years, I practiced in a group, multi-specialty group practice in Corvallis, Oregon, which is roughly halfway between Portland and Eugene. And for the past 2 years, I have been the director of the inpatient care services at Good Samaritan Regional Medical Center in Corvallis. So my background has been taking care of adults with illness. I'm not a surgeon. I don't take care of kids, but I've taken care of older folks. And having worked and spent a lot of time in intensive care unit, I have a fair amount of experience with patients at the end of life and end of life kind of issues. And that's an area in which I'm specifically interested. And I'm sure it's an area that we're all have a personal interest in this as well as we get older. There will be a recurring theme through these sessions, and the theme is really going to talk about aging gracefully, about what health really is in terms of whether it's a goal in itself or whether it's a resource that allows us to enjoy and to live a full life, and that life really is in the living of it. And I think the fact that we're all here at Holden, I think, is maybe a reflection of that. I want to make sure that I give my thanks, because I forget to do this, especially thanks to all my patients who've taught me so much over the years, the previous Elder Hostel groups that we've worked with, and all of you. I know this is going to be a great group of people. And thanks to my mentor, who really introduced me to Holden Village and participated in the first Elder Hostel group, a fellow by the name of Dave Cleaver, who was a retired physician, my mentor in Corvallis, and with a tremendous life experience. And thanks to Gay, my wife here, who has kind of opened my eyes to a lot of things in the world and in interpersonal relationships. Let me tell you about reading. I will have a few handouts, Xerox kinds of things that we'll kind of pass out and we can talk about. But there are four books that and all of these are available in the bookstore here. If you only read one book in your life about health and about illness and about medicine, I would recommend this book. It's top one there. It's by Sherwin Nuland, a surgeon at Yale, and it's called How We Die. This is probably, has anybody read this book? This is truly a phenomenal book that really explains medicine the way it is. He explains a lot about the human body, about the kinds of diseases, about how people die, and what is really important about this whole process of aging and aging gracefully. And I would strongly recommend this book, and I recommend it that if you read it and if you really like it anywhere near as much as I do, and you have a really good relationship with your physician, this is a good Christmas present. I think every practicing physician should read this book, and I highly recommend it. Another book that I highly recommend is the Nun Study. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this. This was a study of aging in a group of sisters. They've actually followed, I think, like 600 of these nuns, and they've been able to keep tremendous medical records and background records. And looking, if you have any interest in Alzheimer's disease and why it develops and how it might be prevented, another excellent book to read.
That is what, please?
I'm sorry?
What is that one, please?
It's called Aging with Grace, and I put it up as the second one there by Snowden. This is also available in the bookstore. Great book. Those two are really great. A short book, but just written by a man with, written by Jimmy Carter, a man of great compassion and insight. Just sort of a nice way of looking at reviewing with him how he views aging and getting older. And probably the bottom line in his book is that one of the most important things about aging is that we continue to give to others, and that we really take advantage of the years and experience that we have, and that we share that with other people. Very good. A book that's written by Daniel Callahan, an ethicist, a little more detailed, a little more, it's not quite as easy to read as any of these three, but defining how we're going to need to change expectations amongst older folks as far as healthcare in the future. We cannot afford to provide absolutely everything to fight every disease, tooth and nail, to the end of life for everybody that gets older in society. It's just something that resources are just not there. Not when we have to educate children, we have to clean up the streams, and we have to provide living for everyone else on this planet. So a very good exposition of that. A little bit harder to read compared to these. Still a very readable and an
What's
excellent
the title
book.
Of that one?
I'm sorry.
What's the title?
That's called Setting Limits.
By whom?
By Daniel Callahan, Medical Goals in an Aging Society. I'll leave all these books out here, and as I said, they're all four are available in the bookstore. And but if you're going to read one book in your life about healthcare, this is the one. How We Die, great book. The goals, at least as I see it, and what I hope we accomplish, is that we raise important questions here. This is not going to be a didactic lecture. There are no slides. There's no high-tech kinds of stuff like you'll get with the geology presentation, because most of the issues are relatively soft. We're going to pose some challenges, and I hope we really stimulate some discussion, a lot of discussion that will probably go on well outside the sessions here, as the issues really do apply to all of us. Health and wellness is a general topic. Today, I want to talk about health. What is health? What is wellness? How do we look at it? How can we measure it? How does it vary from country to country across the globe? I want to say something about the statistics of health and how we do measure it and how we compare costs from country to country. We'll look at some cross-national differences in health behaviors and things that affect health, and I've got some interesting. We'll just throw out some statistics, just not that you need to write them down or remember them, but they may be kind of interesting to you. We'll look at the definition of health and wellness. We'll look at a little bit about the U.S. healthcare system, and then I hope we can have some time to kind of talk about how would we go about designing a healthcare system if we wanted a healthcare system. What would we want in it? what are the basic principles, how you go about designing it in an ideal world, and then how do we get from where we are to where we would like to be. And that would be for today. Tomorrow we'll talk a little more about diseases, more specifically about aging and how aging affects us and what we can expect as we get older and approach the end of life. What are some of the major diseases and what can we do in terms of living a healthy and productive life? You know, how to be a good patient, how to ward off some of these threats that are out there for us. On Wednesday, we'll talk about faith and spirituality in medicine, and I think that's a very exciting area that there's more and more research about that. And I think Holden Village is a very special place and a real great opportunity to explore that area. Thursday, there'll be sort of a general discussion of ethics, so sort of an ethics 101 class as far as medical ethics, of how we make decisions about what's the right thing to do. And that leads into all the controversies and dilemmas that we're facing in medicine now, whether it's abortion or cloning or end of life, physician-assisted suicide, euthanasia. And on the last day, we'll really concentrate on those end of life issues, which are so difficult for so many of us and for our patients and for our loved ones. And everyone here, we've been around long enough that we've seen our parents go through these decisions and our loved ones and our friends. And so I think as we go through this discussion, I am not here to depart or to impart any knowledge or special expertise or anything. I've been around for a while. I'm old enough to go to elder hostels, and I've dealt with a lot of people who have taught me a lot of things, and each of you has, I'm sure, a lot to contribute here just from your own personal experience, your own thought, your own study, as from your own life experience.
Cliff,
I
have a piece of housekeeping I'd like to talk about. The first time that we had met, some of us were trying to use the hearing assistant, and the reason that it didn't work was that it wasn't plugged in in the communication office. And so she says that we can check on it. That's why you couldn't hear anything. And so it's only good for this room, and I will double check to make sure that it's turned on. So if any of you need a hearing assistant for any time that you're in here, feel free to use those, because there's nothing any worse than sitting through something and hearing only half of it.
It's working.
Is it working? Yeah. Good. All right. Very good. Okay. Thanks. Thanks, Cliff.
Thank you, Marianne. If anyone doesn't hear what I say or wants me to repeat it, or you know, just raise your hand, shout. This is really an interchange here, and at any time, questions, comments, challenges. What I say, I think, especially in the early part of some of these talks, are going to be we'll actually deal with some facts as well as opinions. We all have opinions on things, but it'd be nice to actually look at some facts. But even facts, one has to challenge, you know, where they came from, how accurate they really are, and whether they really reflect what's going on. Any questions about the general format? If anybody at any time or in the course of this has some burning question, if it doesn't seem to be part of the discussion, that's okay. We're here to kind of talk about anything we really want to talk about, and we're not really obligated to follow this general outline. But what the outline that we've come up with is something that is kind of developed out of previous elder hostels and what people are basically have been interested in. But if there's other topics you want to discuss, I'm happy to participate in that and facilitate that in any way we can. I thought it would be interesting, when we talk about health and wellness, how do we look at health, to kind of look at it from a global, start at global and then kind of get down to a more personal level. And sort of get a sense for what's going on out there in the world in terms of health. And Gay, if you could, I hope everybody can see there. If we turn that light on. What we're going to do? We've just selected some. Mind anybody way here? We've selected some few representative countries. They may not be representative of the whole world, but the United States, Canada, because there's two countries with different medical care systems. France is a European country, China from Asia, and Botswana just a poor country in Africa, but not certainly not the poorest country in Africa by any means. Chad, Liberia, the other countries that are the poorest. So we're going to look at a few basic measurements of how wealthy the country may be, and what some basic health statistics. It's hard to get a handle on, you know, how healthy is the population. Well, let's look at the United States. We have if we take a per capita gross domestic product, this is not income, it's going to be $35,182. This is 2002 data. This is the latest available data that's out on the web right now. This is all World Health Organization data. So that's taking the total gross domestic product divided by the population, you come up with a number. That's not income. If you took a per capita income, it's probably going to be about half that, because the way the gross, you know, cut down a tree is worth something, that counts as in the gross domestic product, but you only get paid $15 an hour to cut it down. So it doesn't add up that's specifically income, but that gives you an idea of how rich a country is per capita. Life expectancy in the United States, 77.3 years. This is an infant born in 2002, can expect to live 77 years.
Could you put 2002 up there, right below U.S., so that we remember what year these are from?
This is all 2002. All the data from all the countries is all going to be World Health Organization data selected. For a little boy, you don't have to write that up there, it's 74.6, and for a little girl, it's 79.8. So women get about 5 extra years out of life, because men work harder, we all know that. somebody wants to challenge this?
You talk about life expectancy of a child born now.
Right.
But that doesn't apply to our generation.
No, it doesn't. Right. And we'll get into that in just a second.
Okay.
Child mortality. If you're, what's the chance that a child per thousand is going to die before they get to be 5 years of age? And here in, let's just put this up by boys and girls category. But so for boys, and boys it's going to be a nine out of 1,000, and girls 7 out of 1,000. So even from early on, boys have a little more trouble. To address your question a little bit, what's your healthy life expectancy at age 60? So somebody who turned 60 in 2002. How many years of healthy life can they expect? And they define this, World Health Organization defines healthy life as how many years you can expect to live before you become disabled, dependent on someone else. So if you end up in a nursing home, then that's how many years it took. Or if you die, obviously that's the end. So it's either death or becoming disabled and essentially totally dependent on someone else. In the United States, for men, it's 15.1 years, and for women, it's 17.7.
After 60?
At age 60.
If you're healthy at 60?
If you're healthy at 60. Okay. If you're alive at 60. I guess if you're already disabled, this is how we get into trouble. You know, exactly how is that defined? But this, what I wanted to show is some relative things, because they pretty much define it the same for all countries. How much, the next thing is health expenditure as a percentage of gross domestic product. The United States spends 13.9% of all goods and services are spent on health care in the United States. And that comes out to a per capita expenditure of $4,887.
Excuse me, that's for all health care, not just retirees.
No, that's for all health care. That's for immunizations for kids and prenatal care and hospitalizations and doctor's visits and chiropractic treatments and medication.
Per person?
That's what we spend in this country on health care.
Per year? Per person's life, entire life?
Per year. Every man, woman, and child. I mean, obviously, some people, if you had bypass surgery last year and you spent $50,000 on it, you know, that takes care of 10 people. That means 10 people didn't get anything. But that's the per year, per person.
Is that before or after insurance?
That's
That includes insurance. That includes out-of-pocket expense and what's paid for insurance, what's paid for by the government. Just to give you another part of that, how much is does the government pay? The government pays $2,168 of that. We don't have to put that in, but the government pays, the United States, roughly half of all health care expenditures are governmental funded. So that's Medicare, Medicaid. Medicare is the big chunk, simply because older folks use more medical services than younger people. Canada, gross domestic product, higher or lower than the United States?
Lower.
A lot lower?
No.
Yeah. $29,235. That surprise you?
No.
No, Canada's a pretty rich country as well. Life expectancy in Canada, higher or lower than the United States?
Higher.
Higher's right, 79.8. 2.5 years, just by being born a couple hundred miles north of here.
That's... No smog.
I'm sorry?
No smog.
No smog, that's it. men seven, just for interest, men 77, women 82. So women pick up almost 3 years their life expectancy. Childhood mortality, boys 6, girls 5, a little bit better than the United States. Healthy life expectancy at age 60 for men, 16.1. For women, 19.3. Again,
wow.
They live longer in Canada. The babies, the young ones die less frequently. Health expenditures, a percentage of gross domestic product, 9.5%. And what does that come out to per person? Less than the United States, obviously, is going to be $27.92.
That's here?
Yeah.
Yep.
So probably a third less in terms of cost, maybe even a little more than a third, close to 40% less. And yet, life expectancy, childhood mortality, healthy life expectancy at age 60, all better in Canada than in the United States.
They take care of the children.
Well, they have a different health care system.
Yeah, it's not, you're not necessarily better, but
the numbers are better.
If this is the way you define what's health and, you know, where's good and where's bad, you might say better. What about France, higher or lower gross domestic product?
Lower.
It's a little lower than Canada's, 26,809. Life expectancy? Better or worse than Canada?
Lower.
It's just about the same. It's 79.7. But interestingly, men live a little shorter in France, women live a little longer.
What about the boys and the girls?
We're going to get that.
Yeah, it's a red line.
The boys and the girls, 5 and 4, so they're actually a little bit better than Canada, even in terms of childhood mortality. Healthy life expectancy, a little bit better than Canada, 16.5 and 20.5. And they spend higher or lower than Canada in percentage?
Lower.
Turns out to be 9.6%, almost exactly the same, which turns out to be 25.67. So Canada and France are really pretty close. I mean, it's kind of hard to make a major difference between those two. They spend a couple hundred dollars less per year. China, gross domestic product. Now, China's rising, of course. You know, they're increasing, but their gross domestic product per capita is $4,095. This is 2002.
$4,095.
This is 1902, and it's probably 6,000 now. I mean, they are increasing significantly. It's all 2002. Life expectancy in China, higher or lower?
Lower.
Greater than 60 or less than 60?
Greater.
About half and half, you think? How about greater than 70? Would anybody believe it's greater than 70?
Yeah. Yes.
71.1. You know, we sort of think of China as being a backward country, and male life expectancy is 69.6, female is 72. So it's exactly, for a man, it's 5 years less life expectancy in China. Childhood mortality in China, 31 for boys.
Ooh.
This is 30. This is per 1,000 over the first 5 years, so you're talking about 3%. 31, and for girls is 41. It's the only country in which the girl mortality is higher, and there's a reason for that, I'm sure
yes.
you know.
Yes.
It's two-part. Some girls actually killed when they're born, and they may not be cared for as well early on. There's pressure for the one-child family. So that may be a cultural influence on that statistic. Clearly higher. Healthy life expectancy at age 60 for men is 13.1, and for women is 14.7. So you make it, 60-year-old Chinese fellow living in China has only a 2 years shorter life expectancy than someone living in the United States. That sort of blows you away. It kind of blows me away when I look at that. I just wouldn't expect that. But it's true.
It's 14.7. 14.7.
Thank you.
Correct, 14.7. And they spend, as a percentage of gross domestic product, higher or lower than the 9.6%?
Lower.
Anybody higher? Lower. Lower is correct. It's 5.5%. And they spend, this will just, how much do you think they spend? How many people think it's more than 2,000? That would be 50%, wouldn't it? You can probably make that calculation, multiply 5.5 times 4,000. $224 per capita. That's what they spend on healthcare in China. Of which $83 comes from the government and the rest is private. So look at the difference. All right, Botswana. $5,247 gross domestic product. They have a lot of tourism with the ecotourism and stuff that brings quite a bit of money into the South African country. Life expectancy in Botswana, higher or lower than China?
Lower.
Higher or lower than 60?
Lower.
Higher than lower than 50?
Bingo.
Lower. Somebody says lower than 50? Anybody else thinks lower than 50? One person? Are you two?
Lower.
40.4.
Yeah. I'm dead already.
40.4. With men and women ranging between men is 41. Men were 40.2 and women were 43.
Is that a lot of that AIDS?
A lot of it is AIDS, absolutely. But a lot of it is infant mortality and child mortality. Child mortality, 242 for boys, 222 for girls.
Mm-hmm. 240 what, I'm sorry?
242.
And girls for what?
222. I'm sorry, that's not right. It's 104 and 102. What I gave you with the 200 were numbers from Liberia, which is a country that I spent some time in and was interested in, but which is a much poorer country and much higher infant mortality. But still, even compared to... it's 104 and 102 for boys and girls, roughly the same. High diarrheal diseases, malaria, mainly infectious diseases, and AIDS. Healthy life expectancy at age 60, 7.9 for men, 9.7 for girls. Percentage of gross domestic product, 4.3%, and they spend a total of $127 on health. So although their gross domestic product per capita is actually better than what China was, they spend half as much on health care and have just horrible health statistics by these judges. So if this were in Consumer Reports, you would say China would be a best buy.
Yeah.
because they spend very little money and they get fairly good results. I don't think any of us would choose our healthcare to get healthcare in China. For those who've been to China, would certainly agree with that. On the other hand, when you look at how much bang for the buck and how much what's happening as far as society goes, they manage to do remarkably well, spend very little money.
Nikki has a question.
Can you just explain once again that second to last column, that health expectations for gross domestic product?
It's a percentage of the gross domestic product. So if you take how much we talk, I don't have the total number of what we spend on healthcare, but, well, we do it down at the bottom on a per capita basis.
Yeah.
It's the same thing as the per capita. It's the 5.5% of 4,000 is 2,000, and 14% of 35,000 is 4,800. That's where those numbers come from. It just gives you a sense of of how much, how you prioritize healthcare spending out of your total global budget. Any comments about numbers like that?
I have some suggestions about why China does so well. They don't have the money to spend on some of the things that the United States and Canada does that make us sick, like cigarettes and cars that drive fast and, no accident, not as much accidental deaths from lots of cars. They ride bicycles. They're going to get worse.
They do smoke a lot, but smoking, but they didn't smoke as much 25, 30 years ago, and I think smoking is going to be playing a role. They're going to have trouble. They haven't had the impact of AIDS that sub-Saharan African countries have had, so which they will face. But maybe we'll come out in our discussions. The biggest improvement when you're going to spend money on a healthcare system, your big improvement, and we'll talk about this tomorrow on aging and longevity, comes from public health measures, immunizations. Some very basic health things have a huge impact on life expectancy, whereas bypass surgery, organ transplantation, all these things that are highly expensive, come at the end of life, don't really affect these statistics very much. They might affect any one person who gets that. They may live an extra 2 or 3 or 5 years, but when you look at what it does to the population as a whole, the health of the population as a whole is really not dependent on the health of the individuals toward the end of life. And that's where a lot of the expenditure goes. And China does almost nothing at end of life kinds of things in terms of the number of bypass surgeries that they do in China compared to the population compared to the United States, just tiny.
And the other thing that I would wonder is if they go to all the measures that we go through to save an infant.
Oh yeah, you're right.
I mean,
all the money that goes to the prenatal
thing.
Sure they don't.
Sure, no, I think that's a very important one.
About 10 years ago, this woman in France lived, I think, a little over 120. What's the record?
Like? She is the record. You're absolutely right. She lived to be 122 years. We're going to talk about that tomorrow, but thanks for bringing it up. She did live for 122 years, but I think it's important to know that the last 10 years of her life, she was bedridden with severe arthritis. She was essentially totally blind and couldn't hear. So she couldn't communicate. She did. She has the record. No one has been documented. There may have been people somewhere that have lived longer than that, but there are no documented people that live longer than that with birth certificates. So there's an absolute life. There's a limit to how long people can live. I mean, if you think of all the billions of people who lived on the planet, and only one made it to 120.
Well, one of us here will break the record.
Oh, probably. But, I don't know if anybody here, if they thought they were going to spend the last 10 years of their life the way she spent the last years of her life, whether you really wanted to. I mean, that's really our goal, and I don't think many of us have that for a goal. So,
are you going to cover just what percentage of this total healthcare money that we actually spend in the last few years of our life?
I don't have the specific figure, but it's a very big chunk. It's a very big chunk. And it's not only in, it's in the last 2 years of life, and even in the last 30 days of life, it takes up a lot of it. But it varies a lot from city to city and county to county in the United States, percentage of people who die in the hospital in some areas of the country is much higher than is in other areas. For instance, Oregon has the lowest percentage of individuals who die in the hospital. You take all deaths in Oregon, you say how many of these people actually died in the hospital. Of all the states, Oregon has the lowest. New York has the highest. So there's this gradient.
Yeah, hospice.
And it's because of hospice. It's because of hospice and
yes.
And Part of it was driven by the Oregon Assisted Suicide Act that made people very cognizant of how important it was to provide end-of-life care, so we weren't directing people on that direction. We'll have a lot more to say about that, but that's important.
We think that, China is going to probably change a great deal in their health issues because even the short time that we were over there, we saw from the time we were over there in 95 and 98, the style of food intake was entirely different. And, I mean, they were getting more sweets, sugars, and in 98 we actually saw an obese couple of obese children, which you never saw in 95. And so I think their diet...
They're heading our way, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, they're really heading our way.
It's really sad.
And lack of exercise.
Excellent points. I think the other thing is, these are very... You've been to China. You know what the healthcare... Anybody's been to other parts, just traveled to other countries, recognizes that Canada, France, all of Western Europe, healthcare is superb. I think any of us can feel very comfortable. We have a heart attack or a stroke or get run over by a truck, whether we're in France or Great Britain or Spain or Germany or the United States, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, we're going to get good care. There's no question about that. That's not necessarily the case in China. It certainly is not the case in Botswana. You may very well not get very good care at all. So so that doesn't mean that their healthcare system is something we should be, you know, that we should be trying to get our cost down to $224 a year. But what it does point out, I think, is that there's a marginal benefit. As you spend more and more money, you don't get as much bang for the buck. But your first dollars, if you spend them wisely, you know, your first dollars in the healthcare system probably are not going to be to set up bypass surgery for 90-year-olds. It seems to make a lot more sense that we're going to immunize children, and that we're going to provide prenatal care and do some very basic things of that sort. And probably even prior to that, we want to have good drinking water. We want to have good sanitation. So we get right back to some very basic expenditures. Also, this is really crude. When you're just talking about total mortality, and you're talking about a country as big as the United States, or a country as big as China, what does that mean? I mean, if you live in Beijing, is it different than if you live out in a little village out in the desert regions of Western China? And of course it does. And if you look just the United States, there's a couple other things I'll just throw out at you. If we look at the 10 healthiest counties in the United States, and this is from a couple years ago, male life expectancy, 76 years. But if we look at the 10 least healthy counties and look at blacks in the United States, life expectancy, 61 in Philadelphia. Now, a white male in suburbs someplace, and I'm not sure what's the healthy, what have been the healthiest, but it's maybe Phoenix or something, you know, Surprise. Gig Harbor, I don't know, someplace. Life expectancy for men, 76 years, for black, that's white men, for black men in Philadelphia, 61, in Baltimore and in New York, 60, and in D.C., life expectancy for a black boy born today, or at this time, this was, I think, in 2001, 57.9 years.
That's
great. Very good. Now, that's the United States. Now, those figures are in there, so that's why maybe those are some of our numbers. That's why I say it gets kind of
pollution is higher and bigger
things? Guns is part of it, but not all of it. The worst case was not Botswana or Liberia, it's really Bangladesh. It has the worst life expectancy in Bangladesh, extraordinarily poor. But the causes, now poverty, in Bangladesh, the cause is starvation, infectious diseases, and from bad water or sanitation are the major causes of that excess mortality in Bangladesh. In the United States, it's actually, when you look at excess mortality, most of it's caused by increased circulatory disease, not as the gunshot wounds. Homicides is number two, and AIDS is number three. So there's entirely different group of diseases and causes of death in the United States that brings that down.
Would you read that list again? I missed the first one.
Circulatory disease.
Yeah.
So that would be heart disease, stroke. Okay. Very high in black, in blacks in inner city and poor areas. That may be diet, that may be smoking, that may be social economic things. When you try to correct all things out and try to correct for smoking, and the statisticians can do this, correct for smoking, correct for cholesterol, correct for high blood pressure. What seems to be most important is the scale, is your social economic status. Seems to be more important. It's more important than smoking. It's more important than exercise. It's more important than whether you eat the right foods or don't eat the right foods.
More important than genetics?
Well, maybe socioeconomic is part genetic.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, is it how you want to lower the socioeconomic scale because you're less well endowed with intellect, with curiosity, with whatever else it is that makes people move up in the scale? Or is it the community that does it? It's something about the community. And it seems to be, best the people who look at this can tell, is that it's probably both. Yeah.
The same predictor of how well they do in school.
Ah, excellent point, and you she's my plant.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Even stronger than the social economic is education. Level of education makes a huge difference in your life expectancy.
Level of education is synonymous with social economics.
It's not, but there certainly is a relationship. But clearly, people with a higher degree that have the resources maybe get better education, and people with better education maybe are able to generate greater resources in society. But either way, there's this strong correlation with education. What makes us think it's education, this in the nun study? Now, the nuns pretty much a very socialized life they live. They have all access, when they're not, if you have a PhD and you're a nun, or if you do housework as a nun, you have the same health insurance, you eat the same food, you live in the same kind of environment. It's like Holden Village.
No tensions.
So if we come here to Holden Village and we looked at the staff, if they lived here forever, like a bunch of nuns did, and do live in their convents and teach for their whole lives, those here in Holden Village or those who all have to eat the same food and live in the same life and, you know, pretty far correct for all that, those with higher education live longer. Absolutely. If you have a PhD, you live longer than if you have a master's. You live longer than if you have your master's and if you didn't go to college at all. This is relationship. Now the thing is, what does that mean? And it's very hard to interpret all that. But it seems to make a difference. And the data are really pretty supportive of that. There's some other things that are really important, such as your attitude in life. If you have a very positive, upbeat attitude, you live longer than the person who's kind of down and life's kind of miserable. So living in an environment like this with beautiful mountains is good for you.
How much education did that lady in France have?
Don't know. I can't answer that. Just to show, I'm going to throw a couple other things. We're going to get away from all this data, but it's kind of interesting stuff, and that it's not something we think about every day. But I have some, what I think is just fascinating statistics that kind of look at different countries. This is mainly European data, but it's compared to the United States, in terms of health behaviors that we know affect longevity and affect health. For instance, how many cigarettes you smoke per day? Per average per adult. United States, it's 4.9 cigarettes per day per adult.
Oh,
a fair amount of cigarette smoking, but if you think of if 25% of the adult population smokes, and that's about where it is, and each one smoked a pack a day, that would come out to be about 5 cigarettes for everybody. And so that's just exactly where it is.
This includes non-smokers, of course.
It includes non-smokers. Yeah, you include the entire adult population. Of the European countries, which country do you think has the lowest rate? And this would you just
lowest rate of smoking.
Lowest rate of cigarettes per capita.
Scandinavian.
Right on. Very good. Norway, 1.7. Very not many smokers up there.
Sure, not Greece.
I'm sorry.
She said Greece.
Sure, not Greece.
She knows there's a lot of smokers.
Very. Right. These guys are good.
They read your dad.
You must have seen this.
No, I did the Greece.
You've been to Greece.
I went to Greece and got off at the airport.
That's absolutely right. Greece has the highest smoking rate in Europe, and it's 8.3 cigarettes per adult per day.
What is that? No, for example.
Greece.
So Greece has the highest.
Ireland.
Well, so it runs the gamut between 8.3 in Greece and 1.7 in Norway, Finland 2.2, Sweden 2.4, And then this is graded. You go to Southern Europe, they smoke higher. Italy is 4.2. United States, I said, is 4.9.
What's China?
I don't have their figures, but I suspect it's probably close to what the United States is.
Yeah.
Suicides per 100,000 people. Which country do you think has the highest suicide rate in Europe?
One of the Scandinavian countries has high suicide.
Boy, you guys are so good. You don't need me.
But, you know, having lived in Sweden, I heard that statistic then, and they said high sex, high suicide, and high alcoholism. But they also said, we keep really good records. And if you go to Italy or something like that, that's a Catholic country, they're not likely to have the same kind of way of looking at things or recording. Now, that was a few years ago.
They don't want to admit it.
You might not have the same.
So you're saying Scandinavian countries have more obsessive compulsive personality disorder.
Yes.
Keep the records, you know?
Evidently.
I read another thing that I'll just throw out. I don't know how true it is, a bearing on that. But they said that a lot of the dreariness, you know, they don't get as much sun. Their weather conditions are so much different than ours. Lead to quite a bit of depression. Mm-hmm.
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah. Because they're, again, a gradient.
Yes.
The United States has 13 per 100,000 per year. Europe as a whole has 12. Finland has 26, which is the highest. Wow. So Finland is the highest. France is, Switzerland is actually at 20%.
We're talking about suicide.
But you're right, the Scandinavian countries are higher, and there is a gradient. And which one's the lowest? Greece.
Oh, I can believe that.
They don't commit suicide in Greece.
Why? They're
too busy smoking. Or they're committing suicide slowly, I guess that's what it is. Yes.
Do you have any statistics on Alaska for suicide? Yes.
No, I don't.
It's high.
I bet it's high at Elmendorf. And Gig Harbor.
Yeah.
Another thing in China, it might not be so high for smokers, but because of very few women smoke, but that's changing. Their attitude in China is a woman who smokes, they look down upon as being loose and so forth socially. And which I would say is about the same as it was 50 years ago or 60 years ago here.
Yeah.
They're just 40 to 50 years behind us.
Here, yeah.
But it's coming.
Yeah.
How about alcohol? United States, we drink 4.7 liters of pure alcohol. So you have to think like wine is 10% or 11, 12% alcohol. You can make these calculations, you know, beer is just 6% or whatever it is. And so you can make these calculations. So in the United States, we drink 4.7 liters per adult of alcohol per year. 4.7. Europe, 11.1. So almost three times, 2.5 times what we drink here.
Is that because of poor water?
Yeah.
Good point.
And it
varies. It varies all over the place. Lowest in Iceland. They don't drink so much. They drink the same as we do. 4.8. France drinks the most. 14.1 liters of pure alcohol.
And they had a woman that lived
the 122.
So,
but they have a longer life expectancy, right?
No, they actually don't. The life expectancy amongst the European countries varies very little. I mean, it is remarkable. I mean, maybe a year or two, but it's hard to make any pattern out of this. Maybe alcohol does help a little bit. Cigarettes decrease it a little bit, so you know, these things kind of balance. I got one other statistic here. This one will blow you away. This is births out of wedlock. Births out of wedlock. Just to give you, United States. Who thinks it's more than 25% or less than 25% in the United States?
I think
it's more than 50?
No.
It's in the United States, it's 32. In Europe as a whole, it's 24. So we have a higher percentage of births out of wedlock. But there are a few countries in Europe that are considerably higher than the United States.
Sweden.
Finland, 37%.
Somebody over here says
Sweden. Who said Sweden?
Yeah.
Sweden.
They look upon it differently than we do.
Sweden's going to blow you away. 54% of births in Americans in Sweden are out of wedlock. 54%.
Oh, well,
49% in Norway.
Well,
Lutheran.
They get married up.
Yeah, they have a baby and then they get married, right?
I don't know. But the one that strikes you as Denmark is 46%. Guess which one's the lowest? Greece.
3%.
So
Catholics.
I'm not sure. Religion has anything to do with it.
They don't record their numbers.
That's why they smoke a lot.
Well, they report them to the European Union, whether they're right or not, I don't know. But the highest percentage, Iceland. 65% of births out of wedlock. Anyway, I throw those things out, not
yeah, just sleep together to keep warm.
Yeah. That must
so
be it.
Are so different.
That must be it. Anyway, but all those factors go into affecting health, and they're so different in different countries that it makes looking at these gross statistics very, very difficult to really able to draw a whole lot of conclusions. But I thought it would be interesting anyway just to kind of look at some of those numbers and realize how different societies are so different. I mean, how much money we spend is so different. So rich societies, poor society, how markedly different these health behaviors are in Europe. And then you look at life expectancy, it doesn't seem to affect it very much. I mean, you know, a few months when you look at the gross figures.
Are you going to get an obesity in different countries?
That is an excellent point. If there is an epidemic that we're facing in this country, and we are leading, we tend to lead the world on a lot of these epidemics. Obesity is certainly a major one, especially amongst children.
That was our first culture shock. We came back to the States the first time. We didn't realize that we were in China, but when we got back, the first thing we came into the airport, Jan looked at me and I looked at her and I said, "What are you thinking?" She said, "We are really fat, aren't we?" Because you don't see that in China.
Well, let's just change direction a little bit here, and we've been talking about health, and we're trying to get a handle on health, and this is one handle, and this is what the statisticians and the public health people say. They look at these statistics and they can figure out, and bizarre things come out when you do this. For instance, the United Nations came out and rated health, and they, instead of using just three or four criteria that we put up here on the board, they used like 40. And you get into some very detailed analysis, you know, life expectancy at 60, life expectancy at 80, life expectancy at 90, and then you get a lot of childhood stuff, and different infectious diseases, et cetera, et cetera. They came out that Columbia ranked number one. Not Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center, where I got my MD, but Columbia country.
Number one in what, please?
I'm sorry?
Number one in what category?
Best medical care, best statistics, everything.
In South America?
South America, hard to believe. I mean, it is hard to believe. And it's the quirk of these kinds of statistics that can totally mislead you. And so, I mean, no one rationally really believes that that's the best place to get your health care. But when you start putting in these statistics.
So do they not report, or we don't know what they do?
It's probably a combination of all kinds of things, but they do have some pretty good child immunization programs there. Like Cuba ranks very, very high because of its tremendous emphasis on public health and childhood immunization rates. The United States does very badly on childhood immunization. Two reasons. A whole bunch of uninsured people in this country. And a bunch of nuts out there that are so afraid of immunizations intelligent people who have been reading things about how the kids are going to get autism and, you know, where there's no scientific evidence whatsoever for, that they're withholding immunization. So we have that two-pronged at the two extremes of society.
We know too much.
People out on one end that are just acting a little weird, and then a bunch of poor people really don't have access. So the United States doesn't do well. On a lot of those indicators. That's why we end up kind of low, because we have such variabilities. I mentioned your black man in Philadelphia with a 60-year life expectancy. That doesn't help our statistics overall when we know that the majority of people have excellent life expectancy.
Yeah. When I first started teaching, we immunized the children at school. I mean, literally, they just lined them. But it was there. I mean, it was offered for every parent to immunize the child, and now that's just...
No, too many freedoms. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go from the world view to a personal view, and then we're going to go back to kind of a national view of what's health? And what's wellness? Are they the same? Anybody got some?
Being able to function, do your job, take care of yourself, feed your husband.
You're all right. You're
feed your husband.
Feed your husband. So health is having a woman who is who can feed.
Well, not just. I mean, my job is to take meals. My husband's job is keeping the director.
But it's to be functional.
Yes.
To be able to. I mean, that's health.
Yeah.
Any other comments?
That's my criteria for going to the doctor.
Absence of disease.
Absence of disease. I think that's been. No, I think if you picked up a dictionary and looked up health, they would probably say absence of disease. That would be the first part of it anyway.
Live with disease. But we live happy and we do our jobs.
Right. Yeah. Any other comment?
Quality of life is important for health.
Yeah, quality of life is essential.
So you can be functioning but not have a high quality of life.
That can be... negative thing too. The rich people have a lot more access to things that are hurtful to them.
You could afford the alcohol and the cigarettes,
right? Yeah, and there are things much worse than that in drugs.
Sure. Mm.
And there are people who are healthy who can't.
And there's sexual habits.
So there's a lot of factors that go into what can create good health or create bad health.
Yes.
But we're still trying to get a handle on health.
Yes. Mental attitude.
I'm sorry?
Mental attitude.
Very important.
I was going to refine that and say, I think it has a lot to do with your perception of how you think you are. Some people that aren't even really in the best shape, according to somebody else, are perfectly fine. You know,
that's, boy, that is so important. Mm-hmm. That is so important. And a little handout that I have for you later sort of looks at that, how people self-assess their own health. And there's a lot of variability, and you're absolutely right. There are some people that have significant health problems who really minimize those and go on with their life and live a pretty full life, and there are others who...
Or are miserable. It's hard to...
Absolutely miserable, and you can't really find much wrong with them. I've got a couple of definitions here. A healthy state of well-being free from disease. Pretty good. How about a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity? That's the World Health Organization definition. So a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity.
Sounds like Superman.
There you go. How about... how about this one, which I kind of like. Health is a resource for everyday life, not the object of living. Positive concept emphasizing social and personal resources as well as physical capability. And that gets into being functional and being able to...
feed your husband.
Feed your husband. A dynamic state of complete physical, mental, spiritual, and social well-being and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. And within the context of health promotion, health has been considered less as an abstract state and more as a means to an end. Again, this is WHO. As a means to an end, which can be expressed in functional terms as a resource which permits people to lead an individually socially and economically productive life. So it's a resource for everyday life, not the object of living. And so I think that is really important to think of it as a resource, as an attribute, as a characteristic, as opposed to an end or a goal in itself. I think in the United States we have tended and you see us. I mean, all of us at one time or another, I'm sure, have been guilty of what we eat. You know, we're not going to have the ice cream over here because that's going to
adversely affect our health, or we're out there slogging away and jogging and doing all the things that we do in terms of health promotion that are painful in a way. Now, some of those are very good, but we sort of do it not so that we can live a happy, productive, and fruitful life and that we can give to others, but just so that we can be healthy, which seems to not to embrace the wider concept.
So you're saying give up all this pain and have more ice cream.
Life is for the living. I think for someone who's, when we get into our age group, I think some of these the concerns over, you know, what our cholesterol are and everything are probably driving us to behave irrationally and probably not in our best interest. I want to go back to one thing too, because cigarettes are bad. I mean, I absolutely think bad. Alcohol in small amounts of moderation is not only good, not only not bad, it is health promoting behavior. So I just want to make sure that it didn't come across in our discussions here that alcohol fell into the same category as cigarettes or obesity or some of these not exercising, etc.
Cliff, is there a difference between liquor and wine when you make that statement?
I can tell the difference when I drink.
Does the benefit increase with age?
With us or the liquor that we drink? Just the taste, I think. The key is alcohol. Alcohol itself, ethanol, is the key factor. And so the French will tell you it is red wine because they are the number one red wine producer in the world. There's a recent study out from a beer producing state said that beer has all these other phyto something in them that makes beer very good. There are associated behaviors that go with this. If you look at that go with what kind of alcohol you drink, that tend to confound all these studies. Mm-hmm. Hard drinkers, hard alcohol drinkers, tend to be smokers. Not 100%. There's always the exception proves the rule. But if you really love your bourbon, you probably smoke. Not necessarily, but much more likely than if you drink Chardonnay. If you drink your California Chardonnay, you probably jog. So there are these different other behaviors that then make it a little more difficult to say which of these is better or not. But we're getting off the topic a little bit here.
Just one more question about alcohol. Does that induce the relaxation state, though, that a person sits down? I mean, is that
good?
Part of it.
That's part of
having
it.
The drink and relaxing and.
There's no question that alcohol is a social lubricant as well as has some very biochemical effects on the body as well. We think that most of the benefit comes from the biochemical effects. It raises HDL cholesterol, as an example. Does some other things. That
what are we going to have to drink for supper tonight?
Tea. Water.
Green tea versus anything.
All right, so I think we can all agree that health is more than just the absence of disease. It's a broader concept. And that's good on one hand. It has some negative attributes, is that we can medicalize everything that doesn't lead to well-being and a full and productive life, so that if you, everything becomes a disease. Obesity is a disease. Alcoholism is a disease. I guess if you abuse children or your wife, that becomes a disease and has to be treated. So pretty soon, where almost every behavior, everything becomes a disease, and there is a danger in piling everything onto healthcare as responsible in some way for all these other behaviors. But I think the main point, we really are dealing with a much broader concept than just the absence of disease. Any more comments about health, wellness?
Question. Of all these other things there are to drink, milk, coffee, juice, any of those benefit you or don't benefit you?
Yeah.
Soda pop is really bad for you. It has too much sugar, and it's bad for your teeth, and it's bad for obesity. I think soda pop is one of the ills of our society. That's my
I love Pepsi. I drink lots. In fact, there's no Pepsi up here. This is going to be kind of, by the end of the week, it's going to be kind of hard for me. But.
So we see you jogging down to the ferry. The lady that, hey.
Yeah, you know, it's life is really complicated. So you have to balance between those things that are really good for you and those things that you really love. And, you know, it's I don't have an answer for that, but yeah, you know, skim milk is probably better than whole milk because of the fat that's in it. We don't drink enough water, but we got a whole bunch of people walking around with water bottles, you know, in Seattle, where they're absorbing water through the moisture. Now, I can understand that down in Surprise. And I think that's very good. I think if you're thirsty, you should drink, and water is still the best, you know, it's a good thing to drink. This whole thing about 8 glasses, you know, of water per day, there's no, absolutely no evidence to support that whatsoever. Your mind is pretty good at detecting when you're thirsty. When you're thirsty, you should drink, and respond to that. When you're at higher altitude, when you're vigorously exerting yourself, when you're living in a very dry climate and you're doing vigorous activity, you have to consciously try to drink a little bit more there. But if you're carrying out your usual daily activities, working in an office, everybody walking around with water bottles, I mean, I don't really know what that's all about. But it has nothing to do with health. It's good sales and marketing. And boy, they charge. I mean, Pepsi charges more for bottled water than they do for Pepsi.
Yeah. And you can buy water with caffeine in it now. That's the ultimate goal. And then buy the caffeinated water. No.
Well, only in America, right? Yeah. Well, let's look at, we've got a little bit of time here to look at the U.S. healthcare system, and what I thought I'd do is give you my perceptions of what's going on in the healthcare system right now, and then open it up to how, we're here, we want to get somewhere, where do we want to get, and get some input, but very, very briefly, in the United States right now, some of us have what we can define as optimal health care. That's what we really want. Probably most of us in this room have had it or are very close to having it, and that's you have a primary physician that you can relate to, and then you can get your preventive services and your ongoing medical care, your acute care, that you can get referred to a specialist if you need a specialist, and that when you get referred, you have ready access to the latest technology, treatments. You can get it. You get admitted to the hospital and get your hip replaced if you need it, or bypass surgery, or angioplasty, or whatever it is that you need in terms of the high tech. And it's a minimal out-of-pocket expense to you. So if you have conventional indemnity Medicare, you pretty much got that. You can get. You have your primary care doctor. You get into the referral system, and you can go. If you have a more restricted care, such as through a HMO, you're going to have less choice of primary care, you're going to have fewer specialists that you can go to, and you may have some restrictions on what can or can't be done. And of course, if you don't have any health insurance, you have a real problem negotiating the system. During the 1990s, we had just a major problem in this country with skyrocketing health care costs. And in the early 90s, it became apparent that we really were in trouble, and something had to be done. We were spending almost 15% of our gross domestic product on health care. You see, right now, in 2002, it was actually down a little bit to around 14%, but we were up at 14.5% in the early 1990s. The Clinton administration, Hillary tried very hard to come up with a solution and to address the healthcare problem. She went about it all wrong, she had a whole bunch of secret meetings, and she managed to antagonize just about everybody in the healthcare profession. There were no physicians involved in her secret meetings at all. Not a single doctor was involved. They worked with a lot of healthcare advocates, and they had some good ideas, but they
it was dead on arrival in Congress, and after a lot of work and a lot of, it became something that no politician wanted to touch. In the last 12 years, no one has really touched it on a federal level. Why were we getting into problems with cost? Demographics? We're all getting older, we're using more services. Technology is just unbelievable in medicine, and what we can do now used to be able to. Expectations, we all have very high expectations. We really expect good care. We want the latest, we want the best, limitations. Administrative costs in the United States, extremely high. 26% on average of your healthcare dollars go to administration. In Canada, it's around 9%. Medicare runs around 2.5 to 3% for administration.
Extraordinary. Track of all the privacy forms you have
to sign. Oh yeah, absolutely. And the healthcare forms that we fill out here and send to Holy Village.
Yeah.
I mean, keep track of those.
Do it twice.
What is our percentage again?
26% overall.
And it's 9 in Canada.
Yeah. And so that makes up a big chunk of that difference
that
right
cost.
There. Yeah. So we have tremendous administrative costs. Malpractice costs in this country, much higher than they are in any other country in the world.
I'd like to address those forms.
I should have done this.
Let it die.
It's okay. I'm sorry.
Let it die.
Nothing personal.
Comes. I mean, we've been bashing the Pony Express this whole time. It really wasn't the Pony Express. It was Marion Younghans, who wasn't reading the chart right. All of the ones that I had was all of the people who had already turned into your. You had turned them in. It was the ones that were not marked that hadn't turned them in, and those names were not mentioned. So, number one, I need to apologize. Number two, I think there's about 4 people that weren't able to get theirs in, so I'll get to you, and I really apologize for that.
Okay.
I think I'll write to the Pony Express and apologize to them.
Too. It's okay, Mary.
All right, so I'm free.
We had that figured. We had that figured.
Let's hear it for Mary.
Thank you.
Okay, other reasons that the costs are out of control, we probably excessively use high tech in situations where it's not appropriate. We do a lot of futile care. Where the only procedure that you don't have to sign a release for or permission is the most invasive one we do of all, which is cardiopulmonary resuscitation. So if you come into the hospital and you don't, nobody, it may very well be, no one's going to even ask you, do you want to be resuscitated if your heart stops? And we just automatically assume that you do. The default mode is nothing else. We can't do anything else in medicine. We can't draw a blood sample. We can't do anything without your permission. But if your heart stops, we can do everything, including hooking you up to a ventilator, a machine, pound on your chest, just do whatever that needs to be done. So that's...
So there a sign around your neck?
You need to carry a sign around your neck.
Yeah.
No code. If that's what you want, I mean, and in this country, we have high use of illegal drugs, violence, motor vehicle accidents. We have a large number of people with no health insurance
at all, no access to
primary care or preventive services. And those people get taken care of. It's not like they don't get taken care of. When they have a heart attack, they show up in the ER, they get taken care of, and they're going to get good care at that. What we find good care while they're in the hospital, somebody's going to pay for that, and it's cost shifting from Medicare, mainly from private insurance. For those of us who have private insurance, they're going to pay paying more to the hospital, so the hospital can afford to take care of those people who come in with no care. But then when they go home, they have no follow up. They have no health insurance. They can't afford their drugs, and so they'll be right back in again. And it's a very expensive, foolish way to take care of them. So in the early 90s, actually starting in the 80s and the 90s, largely employer and industry driven, we moved to managed care in a very large way across the country. And the plans were to save costs, cut down on expenses, but they didn't cut down at all on administrative expenses because they advertised for people. They paid CEOs millions of dollars in salaries. And what they did was limit they said, well, we can control costs by limiting medical care. So let's give, let's put up a whole bunch of barriers so we can kind of eliminate some of the unnecessary care. And some of that was good, because people were doctor shopping. They didn't like Dr. A, they went to Dr. B. Dr. A got a whole bunch of x-rays and lab tests. Dr. B did the same thing, x-rays and lab tests, Dr. C. And the insurance was paying for all that, and this was getting to be extraordinarily expensive. With managed care, you can't do that. You're going to go to one doctor, you're going to get one set of x-rays, one set of lab tests, and that's the way it's going to be. And that, in many ways, that's good, but it does restrict access, and it eliminates some of the unnecessary care. But it also put up barriers for necessary care and made it more difficult. And they call this the reduction of medical loss. So anytime an HMO has to pay money for a service, that's a medical loss. That's the way insurance industries look at things. It's like, you know, a house goes down in a tornado, that's a loss. If you get sick and need medical care, it's a loss. They don't want losses, so theoretically they should keep you well, but they also don't like to pay anything for it. So that's been less than ideal. And superimposed on all this is this increasing problem of 46 million Americans with no health insurance whatsoever. 46 million with no health insurance. That's 15% of the population. They don't get care often. They postpone care. They can't afford their prescriptions. So they don't get their prescriptions filled. So in all those criteria, it's a problem.
And what percentage of these are children?
Actually, we're doing better because of the child health insurance program that was passed by Congress about 4 or 5 years ago, and welfare. I can't give the precise percentage of children. It's probably 10 to 20% of the total is children. We have a lot of childhood poverty. The United States has some of the highest child poverty.
I mean, I had a child with zero jobs broke.
Yes. But 50% of the uninsured are people who work full-time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're working full-time in this country. 50% have no health insurance. And if you're poor and you're on welfare, there's a big push, get you off welfare, get a job. But when you're really poor, you're on welfare, you get all your health benefits. If you have sick children that you're trying to take care of, and then when you go, you get back, you get a job, you lose your health insurance. Not a good thing.
Doesn't make sense.
So we have a system. Let me just tell you, who's guaranteed health care in the United States? Congressmen. While they're in office, congressmen, number one. Military, while they're in active duty. Veterans, if they're qualified. Restricted group of veterans. Criminals. When they're in prison. Criminals are guaranteed access to health care. And it doesn't matter whether you're illegal alien and you're in custody or not, but if you're an illegal alien criminal, and Oregon just had this case where this guy needed a bone marrow transplant, and he got it, paid for by the state of Oregon, when we have thousands of Oregonians who work in the state, trying to raise their families, paying taxes, that have no access to health insurance. A great system. Native Americans, if they stay on the reservation. The poor, if they're very poor. The rich, if they're very rich, don't really need health insurance. They can afford it. And the elderly, everyone over 65 is guaranteed health insurance in this country. All right, so that's what we have. What do we have missing? You made the point. Missing the guaranteed children. Children are not guaranteed health insurance and coverage. And workers are not guaranteed. I mean, as I kind of look at the world, if you're going to take care of anybody, you take care of the kids, they have to be a high priority. And right up there with them has to be the workers, because they are generating the wealth that allows society to go on. And you want to keep them healthy, and you want to keep them productive. It just seems to make sense. But we don't have a system like that. All right. Each of you has been named czar of the U.S. healthcare system. What are we gonna do? Yeah.
My main concern is the influence of drug companies on what we expect, because we see it advertised and then we go ask for these kind of things. and they're very costly.
Excellent point. You know, there is a consumer-driven demand for these things, which is created by...
That's the only education we have, is what the new product is and that we need it. The whole education thing to me would be the first thing to start with. Why is grandma, who's 91, taking 12 kinds of pills?
So your emphasis would be educate the public about health issues and things like that, so they can make more informed decisions, and that would probably be a very good basic part of your healthcare system.
And I think many times, you know, not to say anything against doctors, but the doctors prescribe medications that really aren't necessary for people. I mean, they just get too many medications, and then they're addicted. Old people get addicted to medication and have to go through withdrawal. So I think sometimes the doctors do not know enough about the drug themselves.
Or enough about their patients.
Mm-hmm. Or their patients.
Or the fact that their patients are getting medicines from other physicians, other specialists, that don't know that they're interacting or potentially interacting. Yes, Peggy.
In relation to what Jerry was saying, all of the ads on the television, you know, lead people to expect they never are going to have a pain. You know, that they've always got to be whatever, in a state of euphoria, which is, you know, totally ridiculous.
That gets back to the expectations, isn't it, that we have about what we expect to be provided with.
It's our right to have.
That purple pill or whatever it is supposed to solve.
Nexium.
Not just the pill.
Point it, but that has worked. I mean, as an example, somebody can say purple pill and everybody knows.
I didn't.
The drug company, I mean, it's working. It's working for
everybody
them.
Everybody takes it.
Go ahead.
Not just the pain, but going along with what they said about expectations, anything you see on TV or hear in the news, if you hear that Bill Gates got some wonderful, fabulous thing for his health, everyone wants that, even though they don't have that kind of money to spend for it.
Or that problem.
But let me just throw out a question there. Are we spending too much, not enough, or just the exact right amount on health care? In the United States, should we, because clearly, I mean, if we want to expand health care benefits, we want to have education programs, I guess most of us would agree that we ought to cover kids, right? I mean, does anybody here think that we ought to keep the system the way it is and not provide universal access for children? How about universal access for working adults?
Absolutely.
Everybody agrees with that? Does anybody think
that... Do the working adults have to be working for somebody, or can they be self-employed?
I just said working adults. If they're working, they're productively working, contributing, they're paying taxes. They file income tax, they get health insurance. That's fair?
Yes.
How about if they don't work? They don't work because they're disabled, or they don't work because they don't want to work. Does that make a difference? Do we still provide them health care?
Yes, because there's a fallout for the rest of us if we don't. It costs us more if we don't provide them with basic health care.
Right.
You're absolutely right.
I mean, the lady way in the back in the red has a comment.
I think this is a very well-to-do country. We spend money on all kinds of things that are not necessary. I think health care is very necessary. I think everybody should have it.
I agree.
Everybody.
I agree.
Who doesn't agree with that? Who feels that health care is not something that should be provided or available to every single person in society?
I would question the way it's provided, even for the elder people who do get it. If I hire somebody to mow my lawn, and he doesn't do a good job, maybe I'll pay him, but I probably won't use him again. Probably I'll even tell him, you have to fix this or that or whatever. But if I hire somebody for a whole year on a contract to do my lawn, he isn't necessarily going to do it that great every time when he knows I'm not going to come around and check, but he's still going to get to come back and do it. And to me, that's the HMO concept, and I hate it. I hate it. They get the money in advance. You want to talk barriers? You really said it. That's the bottom line. They put them up like crazy. I won't bore you with it, but I could give you examples that don't even have to do with me personally. People have been talked out of things that were important because they already have the money, you see.
They no longer have to provide it if they can talk you out of it.
Sure, and they're looking at it from the point of view of a medical loss, if they have to pay for it.
I know we're not going back there, but I like the way you went to a doctor in the old days, and he had to do something, and then send you a bill, and you paid it.
So I'm not...
If you didn't like that, you wouldn't go back there again either.
For those of you who have conventional Medicare right now, if you're a doctor, you go to a doctor, he sends a bill to Medicare, they pay it. If you don't like what the doctor did, you don't have to go back to him, right?
Well, but if you're in an HMO...
I'm talking about the standard indemnity insurance that is Medicare.
If you can get that.
It's a single payer, but it does give a fair amount of flexibility. I mean, there's the downside of that is that you have physicians who can't function as entrepreneurs, which I'm not sure you really want your doctor to be an entrepreneur, and it really in it to maximize his income and make a lot of money by doing things that may or may not be necessary or helpful for you. And I'm not sure under that system, for the point I made earlier about the doctor shopping thing, there's a potential for waste in that kind of thing where people can just go from one person to another. And there are people that do that. Obviously, most of us don't want to be in a doctor's office, so we don't do it. Some do. Yes?
But a cure for that problem would be a sort of a central medical information. I know people just hate the idea, but your medical records go to a number, but they would go to one place and they say, well, this person's already had this care over here.
Yeah, we're moving toward that. And the security and the privacy issues are major concern, but I think that's right. But is there a general consensus in this group anyway that universal coverage for everybody? Now, who's gonna fund it?
If you take away a lot of the marketing money that pharmaceutical companies use and put that into funding, that would be a very big help.
That would.
If you
don't
find more.
Is there a problem with a single payer system? Just the federal government being a single payer here, or do you like the idea of multiple different insurance companies, different plans?
How can we object? We're all on Medicare.
You are, but the country is not. If you were extending this to the whole, if you were...
Yes, I would agree. I would go along with that.
You would go along with
a single payer.
Just expand Medicare to cover everybody.
Yeah. I would think it would be wise to look at Canada and see just what they do. I mean, they have less expense. They have universal care, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
But it's certainly not without problems. They sometimes wait months.
Or years.
Not if it's critical.
And I've been given to believe it's practically bankrupting Great Britain, their system. And they have huge lists for people that can't get things that you could normally go to and get here.
It costs money.
It does.
You know, and so the question becomes, if we spend 14% of our gross domestic product on medical care, and that's enough, if we say that's where we're going to draw the line, then we have the other 86% that we can spend on the environment, on national defense, on roads, on education, on public safety, on fire departments, all the other things that we can, you know, television sets and cars and all the other things. Clearly, medical profession can ramp up that 13% to 25% very easily, you know, and we can, I mean, the need is out there, and the technology is booming, and the baby boomers are coming along in great numbers and with high expectations. So we can spend just tons and tons of money. We're going to run out of time.
And money.
but I think it's something that we really have to think about. Something that could be relatively easily done, which is to take Medicare and just say, we're now going to cover children from birth to age 5 or 12. And we're just going to, they're just going to be covered under Medicare. The system is in place. All they do is come up with the will to do it. And all children would be, have the same kind of coverage that all of us over 65 had. I mean, not a very hard thing to do, and then that gradually can be, over a period of years, expanded to cover the entire population. But as soon as you say that, you have people yell, socialized medicine, socialized medicine, and yet everyone over 65 in this country is living with socialized medicine and basically accepting it. I don't see anybody says we want to get rid of Medicare and go back to where you have to go out and find your own insurance company.
Yeah. And somehow cut down on administrative costs.
You know, Medicare is one of the least expensive in terms of administrative costs. It's extraordinarily efficient when you consider how much money passes through. There's a lot of things that aren't good about Medicare. I mean, I could give you horror stories about conventional Medicare, too, about how things are done. But when you have to compare it to no health insurance or some of the nightmares of billing that comes, any of you dealt with the private insurance companies, it's a nightmare. Absolutely.
And how much of that money is for administrative duties?
Lots. In the United States, it's about 26%. So about a quarter. About a quarter of the money of that 14% is administrative costs, where it's less than 10% in Canada. And most countries run 5 to 10% administrative costs because they have a national system. My hospital is battling. They're having fewer and fewer nurses on the ward. They're trying to increase the number of patients per nurse because nurses are expensive. And then they're trying to say, well, let's hire somebody that's less trained than a nurse, like an aide, to do the work instead of a nurse because they cost less money. And that's where they're cutting costs. Are they cutting costs in the business office?
No,
they can't, because if they cut costs in the business, they need all these hundreds of people there filing papers back and forth, because we deal probably with 150 or 200 different insurance companies. Every one of them has a different plan. Some things are covered, some are not. Some require pre-authorization, some require periodic review. It is a nightmare. Just an absolute nightmare.
When you're saying they can't cut.
No, because if they cut in the business office, they won't get any money, and then they can't pay the nurses either. They have to cut even more nurses, because they need those people in the business office to maximize the billing. Because it's so complicated. So, and the insurance companies aren't going to help you. Insurance are not going to help you fill out the form.
So that new bill that passed for the medication for elders, you really have to be poverty stricken to benefit from that, don't you?
I don't know enough about it. Anybody here taking part in that?
The card. And they advertise that card.
Yeah, no one seems to know what's going on.
Yeah, that's my sense. It seemed like it was a political move.
It was.
Yeah, to try to say we're doing something for the seniors when, it's just so complicated.
I sat down, I keep on talking about prescriptions.
You don't just need to figure out.
I sat down and compared all the benefits. I would lose on that program.
Well,
it cost more.
Thank you very much for your attention to the discussion. Tomorrow, if there's loose ends here, or if somebody comes up with a really great idea on how we can solve the healthcare crisis, let me know and I'll pass it on. And if you have any topics that you really want to discuss in these next 4 days, let me know. But tomorrow we'll talk about getting old. And I do have some...